Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and I'm still in Midland, Texas, at a little research meeting for undergraduates. And while I'm here, I've been visiting the I-20 Wildlife Preserve. Now, you probably don't know what that is, and I must say I didn't, but it's a little playa wetland, and we'll come to that a little later, where they're doing all sorts of interesting environmental research projects, and it's becoming quite an important feature of the West Texas science scene or environmental science scene. So today I have with me then Nathan Knowles. He's the executive director of the I-20 Wildlife Preserve. And also I have with me Derek Faust. He's the consultant environmental scientist for the preserve. So gentlemen, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let me start with you, Nathan, first of all. I mean, tell us, what is a playa wetland?
Well, a playa wetland is a very common thing in West Texas. They exist from West Texas all the way up to Kansas. They are wetlands in this part of the world. We don't have your traditional streams or lakes, as most areas do. The playa wetlands are the primary recharge zone for our aquifers and our water sources. And so they are very important biodiversity centers, as they are the only water available to most organisms out in this area, and they're highly relied on for the migration of a lot of migratory waterfowl and our residents.
So where does the water come from?
It's rainfall. As the rain falls, the little we do get tends to collect in our playas. In Midwest Texas, we have close to 25,000 in this region. The wildlife preserve that we're talking about is one of the 12th largest in this area. It's a 30-acre wildlife preserve playa, and is just a unique setting because it's in an urban setting and hasn't been modified as most playas in this area have been due to farming and ranching.
So how did you come to then have a special preserve? I mean, this is a big acreage, and it's somehow been sort of separated from the rest of the environment for you to do research projects on. So how does that come about?
Well, the property was actually donated to the city in 79 to become a park, and the city never had the funds to develop it. And when Miss Jenna Welch and our president, Elaine Magruder, went out there one day and saw the numerous wildflowers in bloom and the water and all the migratory birds, they just fell in love with the property. And after doing some research, they found out that it was designated to be a park, and that inspired the interest to turn it into a educational facility for students like Derek to come out and do research and teach West Texas about water and wildlife and everything else that's in this area.
Jenna Welch is exactly who?
Miss Jenna Welch is Laura Bush's mother. She still comes out and birds from time to time, and we have her birding records from about the 40s out there. And she used to bring out Girl Scouts, and she was a key person in getting the interest started on the wildlife preserve.
Okay, so then you say there's 25,000 of these playa wetlands all over West Texas, and I think most people would be forgiven for not knowing that, because one tends to think West Texas is, well, pretty damn dry. But it's just remarkable that the water that does accumulate comes up to the surface in those particular areas. Is that the
issue? And most of it's drainage, so it's surface runoff because of the soil.
So this summer, for example, these last few years, the amount of water must have degraded.
The last 2 years, the playas in this region have been almost completely dry. And so they go through a lot of wet and dry cycles as the rainfall fluctuates. As we've been in a drought, there haven't been very many wet playas lately.
Okay.
But they still act as great biodiversity.
Okay, so Derek, that sort of comes to mind, therefore, that you must get an incredible seasonal and yearly variety of what's going on there in terms of the environment. Different species that need water vanish for a few years, plants that need a lot vanish, then come back. Tell us a little bit about what is out there in terms of, you know, fauna, flora, etc.
So there's, like Nathan said, it's a pretty diverse setting, and being the primary aquatic habitat, playa wetlands provide this habitat for a lot of species that rely on aquatic systems for food. You get migratory birds, a lot of duck species come in there.
Well, do they come in every year? I mean, there's no water. I presume they don't come.
Yeah, during the years that there are no water, obviously it doesn't pay for them to land there, so they have to find another resource.
Keep going,
or yeah, basically keep going. It would be their only choice. And in terms of other fauna that are out there, I know there's been a bobcat sighted. I was just out there today. I didn't see them, but there was a hawk around. I could hear them. And I've seen rabbits. I've seen signs of all kinds of different things. So in terms of plant diversity, wetlands themselves are known for their plant diversity. And playa wetlands, there's a lot of different plant species that can occur in and around playas. It's not only in the playas themselves, but the upland, what is considered the upland, can support a lot of different species. And the seed bank, it's really cool because they're ephemerally moist, meaning they go through these wet and dry cycles. The plants, when it rains, you'll just get this beautiful bloom of all these different plants. Because
just driving in this morning on I-20, just an abundance of all yellow flowers. I mean, there's nothing else there except the yellow flowers. But, I mean, I guess that's just one particularly hardy species that's come about because of recent rain.
Right. You do get that some species tend to dominate. I know the first time I visited the site, there was an abundance of cattails, which Nathan has worked to eradicate them because that's not exactly what you want. You want a little bit more diversity, and cattails have a tendency to have that ability to take over. So
you're playing a little bit of God here. You're not just letting whatever develops develop. You're trying to manicure this a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. You want it to be something that people can use, and that's one of the main purposes of this. It's not only from a research standpoint, but it's also from an educational standpoint. So you don't want people to go out there and say, well, there's only cattails. I thought you said this was a very diverse habitat. So having that different diversity and maybe not totally eradicating, but reducing some species and then planting other species, right, and helping to establish other species helps deliver that message. But it really has, from the first day that I saw it to now, it really has changed quite a bit. And not all of that is because of human interactions and changes. Some of that has just occurred naturally and from
what time of period are we talking about? When was the first time you came here?
The first time I was at the site was, I believe it was in November of 2010, I guess it was.
Okay, so not a very long period of time.
No.
So even in that short 2-year span, effectively, all sorts of things have changed. So this is a very dynamic area.
Yeah, and between those wet and dry cycles, your vegetation changes.
Yeah.
You know, because you have some species that are a little bit more hardy in dry conditions, so they tend to pop up, but then they don't like wet conditions. We, as scientists, we use the terms obligate wetland species, that they can typically, they only are found in wetlands, and then you have your upland species that are typically only found in more dry, not as moist soils. So, and you have
you
this.
You can fluctuate here.
You can, absolutely.
Sometimes it's damp, sometimes it's pretty dry.
Absolutely. And that's what really makes it interesting, because other wetlands typically don't go through those cycles as often. In West Texas, particularly, even in a fairly typical year, you still have a wet period or a wet season and a dry season. So even within a year, you can see that type of variation.
So you say, and correctly so, that, I mean, not only is it just to do a research topic or project out there, but you also got to think about it, its utility. And here in this particular part of the world, it's actually a resource for people to go and use as a park, perhaps, also. I mean, can people picnic out there, or are there certain restrictions of what you can and cannot do?
Well, it is a park in the sense that it is open to the public, but it is not a park in the sense that it's for picnicking and horseback riding or anything like that. It is an educational facility for a wildlife preserve. It's there to shelter the wildlife in the surrounding area, as it is surrounded by industrial entities.
Yeah, I mean, actually, that's a good point for people who don't know anything about this part of the world. This is in the middle of the Great Permian Basin. This is one of the great oil-producing, natural gas-producing regions, and I had helium, gaseous helium-producing areas in the whole wide world. And so driving in this morning, you can get a whiff of getting here way before you can see these little things pumping oil out. So, I mean, is that an issue in this environment? The local generation of hydrocarbons, as they seep up to the ground, is that at all an issue for you?
Well, that's part of what we've opened the preserve to see, is to, as Derek has found in his research, is that there are some contaminants being in an urban industrial setting like that are going to enter into the site. But also at the same time, we need to know at what levels is it dangerous, and also to just kind of to track the history. And that's why we've set the preserve up to be a research place, a long-term, to take these samples over time to see what kind of effect these industrial areas are having on us.
So it's not just a beautiful place that people can relax and see variations, fauna and flora, but in fact you're going to learn something about how do these sorts of locations coexist with industrial activity around the corner. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm talking with Nathan Knowles. He's the executive director of the I-20 Wildlife Preserve just outside of Midland, Texas, and Derek Faust, who is the consultant scientist for this project. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Most diet pills promise you lose weight without breaking a sweat, which always makes me nervous.
But here's a new concept, a pill that makes you want to exercise. It's not a pill yet, but scientists found when they injected high amounts of a hormone called erythropoietin, or EPO, mice became more active.
You may know EPO is a performance-enhancing drug banned by sports governing bodies, including the Olympic Games and the Tour de France.
Athletes are attracted to EPO because the hormone can increase red blood cells in the bloodstream, giving the body more oxygen, which equates to better performance.
EPO is naturally produced by cells in the kidney that sense when oxygen levels start to dip. EPO binds with receptors in the bone marrow, where it stimulates red blood cell production.
In the past 15 years, 18 cyclists have died suddenly in their sleep from using EPO. Injected in repeated small doses, too many red blood cells can end up in the bloodstream, thickening it and clogging capillaries.
The risks are stroke and heart attack. Athletes are more vulnerable since they tend to become dehydrated, further thickening the blood.
However, researchers found that instead of repeated small doses, when given in acute high doses, EPO crosses the blood-brain barrier. It helped mice run better, even though it did not boost red blood cell production.
This meant EPO acted as a brain hormone that motivated the mice to exercise more without changing its physiology. If proven safe, EPO can help people who are obese and quicken recovery for people rebuilding muscle mass after a long illness.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Nathan Knowles, Derek Faust from the I-20 Wildlife Preserve. We're talking about this as a facility for people to go out and enjoy, see the flowers, see the animals, see the variations from season to season, and an educational facility, and also a little bit of a research facility in order to see how some really urban park, in a sense, can coexist with industrial activity around. So, Derek, what's out there that shouldn't be there as far as you're concerned?
Well, in the surrounding area, and I wouldn't say that there's anything out there that shouldn't be there. This
very diplomatic.
Well, you know, I learned through the course of my studies that as scientists, particularly with the environment, I'd love for us to be able to coexist with Earth and not have any effect on the environment. Unfortunately, that has not happened through our history, and some things happened throughout our history. We didn't know that we were affecting the environment.
Exactly.
40 to 60 years ago, we didn't know the value of wetlands. Now we do, and now we're working to preserve them, restore them. Nathan can tell you he pulled dozens, if not hundreds, of tires from this wetland. Wetlands historically were viewed somewhat as a dump. So I wouldn't necessarily...
Let me interject there. What do you think has caused this change in gestalt, the way people will look at this, from dump to resource?
I think research played a large role in that. Overall, it's hard to say how that actually started. In my field, the formation of the EPA, the passing of Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, played a huge role in this, the environmental sciences coming forth and research really driving how decisions are made. And a big part of that, I'll put a little plug in, this year is the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson, of course, being published. And she really... In terms of environmental toxicology, which is part of my field and what I have my master's in, she really brought the public knowledge and increased the public awareness of environmental issues, particularly regarding DDT and its use. Everyone seems to be familiar with DDT and the eggshell thinning with bald eagles and everything. That's the primary, but it's so much more than that.
And in a sense, it's all so much less than that, too, if I might interject, because the title of that book was just magnificent. Silent Spring, because what do you think about in spring? You think of the birds chirping away and all that stuff going on out there in nature. And, of course, then DDT became a big culprit. And that's great for an advanced society like Western Europe and North America, but there are societies where DDT is absolutely needed in order to fight the mosquito threat, malaria, and it just shows the complexity of living on this
Earth. Without DDT in the United States, malaria is, for the most part, if not completely eradicated. Without DDT and other pesticides that we no longer use, that may not have happened. That's totally conjectural, of course.
No, but I mean, it's one of the dilemmas that environmental science comes up to
in terms of
social science.
You really have to weigh the, you know, the pros and cons of that. And shooting off of that, we still use pesticides. Right. They're not as persistent. DDT, one of the things that I detected that in the sediments of this urban playa.
And it hasn't been used for a long time.
And it hasn't been used. It was banned many years ago.
And why would it be out there?
Basically because it would just drift.
Right.
You know, they would spray and it would drift. Yeah. And it could also, they could have used it in an urban setting to try to decrease the mosquito population in the urban setting. It's really hard to say without looking at public records, but the agriculture, you know, was, and to a certain extent there still is some agriculture surrounding Midland. And with the wind in West Texas, it doesn't take much for a lot of drift to go on.
Just say it came from Arizona.
Yeah.
That's a safe bet. The westerly winds, they bring the smoke over here. I mean, last summer when they had these tremendous, terrible forest fires, I mean, in El Paso, which is, you know, it's 300 miles away or something. But, I mean, I'm sure you got remnants of that smoke all the way over here.
Yeah. So from that, it really could be the drift, and that DDT is just so persistent. So now we've moved away from things that pesticides that are less persistent in the environment. So that's a good thing. But going back to your question of what's out there that maybe shouldn't be there. It's not going to go away. And that's sort of the point of this urban setting. I was out there earlier today with another fellow, and he's like, I wonder, is there any plans to put up like a sound barrier because you could hear the highway? And I said, you know what? I don't know, but as much as it might be nice not to have that sound interjecting, but it really drives home the point that you have this, and you have this beautiful piece of land, and 200 yards away is an industrial park.
Right.
You know, so you can have this and still have this beautiful biodiverse wetland, so, and you can coexist.
You're sort of a consultant to the project, but I gather then you're also doing research out there, which is aimed to be your dissertation, your PhD in environmental science, right?
Well, the research that I performed out there was actually part of my master's thesis.
Okay.
So now I've since moved on from, and that was at Texas Tech University at the Institute of Environmental Human Health, and that was in environmental toxicology. Now I've since moved on, doing my PhD at Mississippi State University in wildlife, fisheries, and aquaculture, focusing on water quality. So still a very similar research area, but different. I'm trying to maintain the relationship that I have with I-20 and Elaine and Nathan. They've been great to work with, but I know that they want to continue the research.
And it's difficult if you're in Mississippi.
It's difficult if I'm in Mississippi, right. Absolutely. So,
well, just let's give us a précis then of what you did for your master's thesis using the I-20. I mean, what did you went out there? Obviously, you did a lot of analysis in order to be able to find out what is there. So tell us what you found and what you did with what you found.
So what I have found, or what we did, the purpose was to sort of make sure that this would be what they want it to be and what we want it to be in terms of providing this habitat that wildlife can thrive in, essentially. But if you have pollutants or contaminants, let's say, out there that won't allow that to happen, then we need to do something to remediate that. So that was sort of my job, to come in and see if that was, if there was that possibility.
So you had the initial screening, in a sense.
Yes. Yes. So I came in, and the first part, this was sort of a two-tier process. The first tier was coming in and looking at the contaminants. Now, obviously, there's any number of contaminants that you could screen for. I tried to do some research and see what might be possible from an urban setting and past uses. So started off with metals analysis. Essentially, we use the term metals. So we looked at lithium, iron, chromium, cadmium, mercury, and I'm missing a couple, but it was 7 or 8 different elements. I mean, there's many more elements that we could have screened for, but those are the ones that we thought maybe.
Well, certainly things like cadmium and mercury are not your normal common or garden.
Exactly.
Or materials out there.
So we screened for those, and from that, we were looking, focusing on the sediments. A lot of contaminants have a tendency, especially you're dealing with this wetland that goes through dry cycles. So if there's no water present, it's when the water dries, it's going to go into the sediments. So you would expect most of your things to be in the sediments, and that's the easiest way to detect them. Then.
How far down did you have to dig, in a sense, to get the samples?
We took our sediment cores. Well, initially, we looked at 20 different sites throughout the playa and throughout, well, not only through the playa, but throughout the site. Then we toned it down a little bit and focused it. But those initial 20 sites, we just looked at those 6 or 7 elements, and we discovered that we had higher concentrations at the lowest point in the wetland for a lot of these elements, which makes sense. Everything flows to that low point, mm-hmm. so you get high concentrations. And the biggest one was lead. Now, start to think about lead in an urban setting, right next to the interstate, and leaded gasoline comes. So it's fairly likely that historical use of leaded gasoline resulted in those high concentrations of lead. We also had some higher concentrations of arsenic and chromium. Yeah. And the arsenic, there were some arsenic-based pesticides. So again, maybe some historical use. And chromium, well, there's some surrounding industry, maybe some plating industry that maybe it could have come from. But that's harder to say.
But anyway, the point being that your initial screening identified
certain
these
areas,
materials and these elements in this particular case. And, you know, these aren't your normal garden variety of metals that you'd hope to find.
Correct.
Okay, now you found that they're there. What are you going to do?
Well, from there, we went and focused on more sites, went out and collected more samples. And the point of that was we wanted to do the organic side analysis, so looking for pesticides and other organic contaminants that might be there. So we focused on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs for short, polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, and various pesticides, particularly
the usual culprits.
Yes, the usual culprits, particularly organochlorine pesticides, and one malathion, which is a organophosphate. And they have their own modes of toxicity. And,
right. And you found those also.
So with the organics, we found not all of the PAHs that we screened for were there, but there were some that the anthracenes are the ones that are sticking out of my mind. And we did not detect any PCBs, which is a good thing. PCBs aren't used anymore, but they are used in transformers. So luckily, it seems as if we have no inputs from that, which is a good thing.
Yeah, when you do this analysis, I mean, and I'm a chemist, so I know that we've got incredibly sophisticated techniques. You can go down to levels which are so unbelievably low, right, that you begin to test your credibility of what it really means to be so low, and is it right. An issue? But also I know that you'll have to have found other locations to make comparisons with. Right. I mean, do you have test places which are so mm-hmm. remote that then when you do the analysis, now you can say, the playa does have abnormally high amounts?
So you bring up an excellent point. So we did all these analyses, and there are guidelines out there for what levels may be bad for, you know, organisms living there, threshold concentrations, we'll call them. Well, that's what they are. And some of our contaminants were above those threshold concentrations, which are established by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. But you have this mixture of compounds and pollutants. There could be different things going on with these mixtures, so we need to find out. So that led to the second tier of the project, which was toxicity testing of the sediments.
But before you go to the toxicity, tell me, did you actually find a location well away from any industrial activity?
So, so we had a reference playa, a grassland setting. Nathan himself went out there and collected some sediment for use, and we determined the concentration, everything that we did for the sediments from this urban playa, we did on that grassland playa sediment. And same thing for the toxicity test. So, yeah, we had a point of reference.
And your playa was higher in levels of all these materials?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So the toxicity studies are just to sort of, in a sense, prove what you already know, that PAHs and PCBs and mercury and cadmium, they're not healthy.
Right. So, well, here's the interesting thing. We went and did the toxicity test, and, you know, for the most, yeah, we found these pollutants, and they were above our guidelines, but I had an inkling just based off of what I saw. I'm like, I don't know that it's really having all that big of an effect, but we need to be able to demonstrate that. You can't just say that. So that was the point of the sediment toxicity test. Right. So we had these sediments that we collected, took them back to the lab, and set up experiments with an amphipod. Its scientific name is Hyalella azteca, and exposed them to the sediments. Now, we use these organisms because they live at the sediment-water interface, so they're interacting with the sediment. So we did the toxicology studies, and we looked at survival length and mass of them, and we saw reduced survival at one site, coincidentally the same site that had the highest concentrations of the metals. That reduced survival at one site probably isn't ecologically relevant, and based off of other things that we saw, it's a pretty healthy ecosystem.
And it's just par for the course. I mean, and that's the other point.
Right.
We cannot have an urban park, it seems to me, that doesn't have some levels that we can detect.
Correct.
Well, anyway, you had fun with that, and you got a master's degree out of it, so that should be pretty happy.
I'm very happy with it.
And so, Nathan, then, you've had this analytical study, this environmental study on the preserve. What's next for the preserve? What are you trying to do in the next, say, 5 years?
Well, our long-term plans for the site is to continue to foster education and research on the facility, whether it's plant life, the fauna, the flora, sediments, air quality, whatever it may be. We want to continue that and getting students out there to utilize the site and also to take some long-term data. We would like to set it up as a long-term ecological research site so that we have this long-term data that can be used as a regional base point as people are doing research.
Stimulate all the other 24,999 pliers that are around to sort of emulate.
Derek started some of the first research in the urban playa setting. There's only been one or two papers published in this area, and it's an unknown element in the science world. And so people are starting to do this, and we have baseline data that any student can then develop from, whether they want to go with sediments or birds or frogs.
So Nathan Knowles, executive director of the I-20 Wildlife Preserve, and Derek Faust, now a graduate student in environmental science at Mississippi State University and the consultant, environmental consultant to the I-20 Wildlife Preserve. Thank you both very much for being here. It's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'd like to thank Norma Martinez, for putting this all together so it makes sense in the end. And we'd like to thank you for coming back each week to listen to Science Studio, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.